This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We all recognize this sound. It's a healthy heart at work. But heart disease remains a leading cause of death for men and women across the country, and increasingly more people are suffering from heart failure. But only a tiny fraction of patients who could benefit from a heart transplant each year receive one, and heart failure has an economic impact. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates the cost of health care services, medications, and lost productivity at more than $34 billion every year. In the Milwaukee area, Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin have a robust program to treat patients at all points on the heart failure spectrum. One area doctor who works with heart failure patients every day is Claudius Marr. He's an advanced heart failure cardiologist at Frederick and the Medical College. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that heart failure is an overlooked public health concern.
I think it's unfortunately somewhat underappreciated. Anywhere from 5 to 7 million people in the United States suffer from heart failure. And across that continuum, almost 60% of patients will die from that disease process within 5 years.
So what are some of the contributing factors here?
So depending on the age, different things lead to patients developing heart failure. So in younger patients, sometimes untreated long-standing high blood pressure. In older patients, coronary artery disease, blockages to the heart arteries will cause the heart to weaken over time. It's more than patients with lung cancer, prostate cancer, HIV, and AIDS combined passing away from heart failure every year.
Do most patients recognize these symptoms, or is it really just that they're experiencing the symptoms of those contributing factors and then they find out, wow, it's caused this heart failure?
For the most part, unfortunately, there are no specific symptoms to heart failure. Some patients develop fluid retention. Other patients just experience fatigue, shortness of breath, fairly vague symptoms that a lot of times go unchecked for long periods of time.
Does that make it hard for doctors to pick up on this issue before it becomes as serious as it can be?
Thankfully, there are very effective testing and screening methods, anywhere from routine blood tests to specialized blood tests that are associated with heart failure to electrocardiograms, EKGs, echocardiograms, ultrasounds of the heart that look at squeezing function, and that's how we're able to diagnose patients. The problem is that along that continuum, oftentimes patients that would have been able to be managed by addressing their risk factors for developing heart failure end up not getting diagnosed until later when they're having symptoms.
Explain that continuum a little bit more. I think when people hear heart failure, they immediately think, oh my gosh, I'm dying right now.
So the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology stage heart failure from stage A, which is no evidence of structural heart disease, but at risk for developing heart failure, to stage B, which is some evidence of damage to the heart, meaning enlargement or thickening of the walls, but patients never had symptoms, to stage C, which is the classic, what we think of as heart failure, patients who are symptomatic and have structurally abnormal hearts, all the way to stage D, which is patients that have advanced heart failure that can't be managed with conventional medications alone. So ideally, we would pick up patients at stage A, treat their risk factors aggressively, and delay or avoid entirely them progressing to develop symptomatic heart failure many years later.
What happens to the body as it goes along this continuum if it hasn't been picked up in those early stages and over time it just progresses?
So eventually the heart gets to the point where it can't meet the body's demands for either oxygen or nutrients. And that's when patients become symptomatic and experience symptoms like shortness of breath, fatigue, the inability to engage in activities of normal daily living, climbing stairs, walking, exercising, those kinds of things. But at that point, the prognostic part of it means that patients tend to do not as well as they could had they been picked up earlier on. So unfortunately, the symptoms happen relatively late, And when they do happen, the disease course is much worse than if we picked it up earlier.
What do you do if you are able to catch it early on? What is the treatment and what kind of changes do the patients have to make to their lives?
So the first thing we try to do is to figure out the cause of heart failure. So if high blood pressure contributes to it, we identify that and we treat the blood pressure aggressively. If cholesterol, diabetes, sleep apnea, those kinds of things play into it, we address those and we treat them. And then we have very effective medications that are designed to help with the process of strengthening the heart and reversing some of the damage.
Is it possible to stop heart failure once that process begins?
Once patients are symptomatic from heart failure, meaning they have structural changes to the heart where the heart is weaker or stiffer or thicker, and they have symptoms, usually it's impossible to completely reverse it, but a lot of times we can improve it with medications. About a third of patients get much better with conventional medical therapy. A third don't improve much structurally, but feel much better and do well long term. And another third gets worse over time and needs specialized interventions.
Well, tell us then about the treatments that are available for patients who unfortunately have gone to the advanced heart failure stage.
There are about 5% of patients of the total heart failure pool who progress to what we would call advanced heart failure. So essentially what advanced heart failure means is you must have been treated for heart failure with the best available therapies, medications, diuretics, pacemakers, and still have symptoms or continue to deteriorate. So typically those are patients who are unable to walk at least a block or climb a flight of stairs without feeling short of breath or fatigued, at rest, or with minimal exertion, and that's what we would consider advanced heart failure.
What is the option at that point?
So really there's a limited number of things available. For the patients that are candidates for that, there's heart transplantation. And heart transplantation is very effective as a therapy, but the problem with it is it's limited by the donor pool. So there's about 150 to 200,000 patients in the United States who would theoretically be in need of a heart transplant. The problem is that there's only about 2,200 donor hearts available every year. The second option for patients, either as a bridge to a heart transplant or as a therapy alone, is something called a ventricular assist device or a surgically implanted blood pump.
Now, explain what that is.
So essentially, these are mechanical devices that take over for the failing left ventricle and support normal blood flow to the rest of the body. So they've come a long way since their inception. The first generation was somewhat cumbersome and not all that mechanically reliable. The second and third generation devices are much better, to the point where 90% of our patients at our institution are alive and well a year after they undergo that surgery.
You mentioned that it serves as a bridge until a heart becomes available. How long, then, can a patient traditionally expect to be on this VAD, I think it's called?
So, unfortunately, the wait time for a heart transplant is increasing, ever increasing, across the United States and in all developing countries because the donor pool is getting smaller and the medical therapies have resulted in the unintended consequence of older patients, more patients that are older with more heart failure. As medical therapy has improved, patients are surviving their heart attacks, their cardiac arrests, they have bypass surgery, angioplasty, stents, pacemakers, and things that 20 years ago would have been fatal, now patients are surviving. So it's interesting in the sense that that then leads to more heart failure 10, 15 years down the line. It also makes patients poorer transplant candidates. So somebody who would have been a great transplant candidate when they were in their mid-40s or 50s now is really pushing it when they're reaching the age of 65, 70. And so the wait time for a heart transplant is about 18 months. If you take patients who have end-stage heart failure and require intravenous medications to support their heart, their expected survival is very, very short. Untreated, most patients pass away within really weeks to months. So the ventricular assist device is a means of essentially optimizing patients for the heart transplant and allowing us to have them wait for that donor heart becoming available. So we know that 90% of patients are alive 1 year later, and we know that close to 90% of patients are successfully bridged to a heart transplant. As the wait times increase and the devices get better, we're not exactly sure how long somebody that we implant here today is going to live, because unfortunately those studies haven't been done yet. But the devices are to the level where they can, at least on a bench, run for very long periods of time, years. The trade-off to the device is our patients are no longer in heart failure, and they actually feel, for the most part, very well. So if you look at how they felt when they had decompensated heart failure, not able to do anything, not able to really live, to the point now where most patients with a ventricular assist device in our hands are able to do anything and everything with the exception of contact sports and submerging themselves in water, because water and electricity are a bad combination.
What do these devices look like? I mean, it sounds like the patients don't necessarily have to be staying in the hospital while they have these devices.
Yeah, so the devices themselves are very small. They're what's called continuous flow devices. So they pump blood continuously from the left ventricle into the ascending aorta and the big artery in the body. And they're actually very small, so they're miniaturized to the point where we can use them even in small adults and sometimes in children. The battery pack itself, the part that's outside of the body, is probably about the same size as your tape recorder. The part that's implanted into the heart for the third generation device sits directly on top of the heart, so it doesn't require a pump pocket or a major kind of space in the body, which is actually very small. So they would easily fit into the palm of your hand, the entire device.
As the devices are being able to help more patients, bridging that gap as the wait times are increasing, are we going to see a switch to where the focus will be on the devices versus having more people become donors?
So sadly, that switch is already happening. The most recent article published about this was from our colleagues out of New York, and what they showed was that a few years ago, over half of patients would get routinely transplanted after their ventricular assist device was implanted. Now that number has dropped to about less than 20%, and what that means essentially is that the wait times are increasing. Patients are still getting transplanted successfully, thankfully. No one is dying because of that, but the way patients get transplanted, because the devices have gotten so good, means that a lot more patients essentially have to wait a longer period of time. And the problem with heart transplantation is that even though it's the gold standard, it's not perfect. So the median survival across the United States after a heart transplant is about 15 years. 15 years may seem like a long time when you're 66 years old, but if you're 33 years old and have heart failure from chemotherapy or from an autoimmune disease and have young children, all of a sudden those 15 years become a very short period of time. So ultimately, we hope that we are able to improve the devices to the point where they're fully implantable, meaning they don't have an outside battery supply, and reduce the risk of infection that way, and at the same time provide transplantation for patients that truly benefit from it the most, because we don't see the organ donor pool getting any bigger.
How long have you been practicing, and what is it like for you to see this evolution of these devices and how they're helping patients today?
So I graduated from medical school in 2004. And it's interesting, when I finished my specialty, which what I do today is I'm a board-certified advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist, that didn't even exist. So I saw the first generation of pulsatile devices that essentially were large, looked like something out of a hardware store, to the continuous flow devices that were kind of like a propeller mechanism on a jet ski and were technologically much improved, to now to the point where we have these devices that are coming out that are yet smaller and yet more mechanically reliable. So it's a very rapidly evolving field, and it requires a specialized skill set that typically you need a large academic medical center for.
Tell me about the program here between Frederick and the Medical College, and how many patients are you treating in this kind of advanced heart failure category?
So we have about 300-something advanced heart failure patients that we currently manage. And we do a ventricular assist device implantation pretty much every week or every other week at this point. We have a cohort of post-transplant patients that we follow after their heart transplant. And so it's plenty to keep us busy. We have a phenomenal multidisciplinary team that consists of heart failure cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, coordinators, nurses, social workers, psychologists, engineers, perfusionists. So it's a very, very large team that essentially practices to have those patients afford the best possible outcome.
What would you like listeners to know about heart failure, their risks for heart failure, and the treatments available?
So I think it's important to routinely follow up with primary care physicians to undergo screening for things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, sleep disordered breathing, sleep apnea, things like that, to avoid developing heart failure to begin with. And then when patients do develop symptoms, to seek medical attention in a timely fashion. And for those patients that develop symptoms despite all of our best efforts, to then consider being seen in an advanced heart failure program to have the best possible outcome.
Well, Dr. Claudius Marr, thank you so much for speaking with us on Lake Effect.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Claudius Marr is an advanced heart failure specialist at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. There's a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. When we return, we'll talk about some of the many accents and dialects that shape how we talk in Wisconsin and learn how Wisconsin talk sounds different from what we'd hear anywhere else in the country. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Pickle Patch, Bubbler, Tavern Belly, Brats. Wisconsinites have regularly employed a colorful and unique vocabulary thanks to multiple waves of immigration from the 1800s through the present. But there is also incredible diversity in language use in different areas of the state and even within single cities. A new book written by a collection of linguistic scholars expounds on our state's history, policy, and culture towards language use. Eric Ramey, professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison, and Thomas Purnell, professor of English at UW-Madison, are the co-editors and their contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom about Wisconsin's rich cultural and linguistic heritage, which extends to both accents and dialects.
Wisconsin has been known for having a particular sort of accent or dialect from the upper Midwest area, and people tend to joke about that and think primarily in those terms. But there's a lot going on with language here that's sort of separate from English. In our book, we have a chapter on Native American languages, and I think this is the starting point, but also taking through immigration, both old immigrants like German, Polish, and also new immigrants such as Hmong and Spanish speakers. We picked four communities that we were very interested in because we felt that they had unique characteristics. So we picked Milwaukee, because we felt like with the African-American community and the intersection with and sort of the issue of race and language, that was really important. We also picked Wausau because we felt like that was important because they had two groups of old immigrants and two groups of new immigrants. And we wanted to try to see how we could help them to learn from the past of the old groups. We also picked Mineral Point because we felt like that was very different. It's a different part of the state altogether in terms of the speech patterns. We felt like that was an important
– Southwestern.
Southwestern, right. And then we picked Rhinelander, which also was important for sort of as a center for Native American language issues, as well as also for issues dealing with the North Woods aspect, that both the perception of North Woods individuals and also their language might be different from sort of this Germanic, you know, dominant area in the Southeast.
I noticed that in many instances, members of various immigrant and Native communities were forced to assimilate their language and culture and conform to standard English. But then I was surprised to read that Wisconsin actually established an emigration office in the mid-1800s, specifically to attract Germans to settle the state. Do you think that this cultural acceptance of Germanic culture affects the way we speak in Wisconsin today?
That's a good question. Not being from Wisconsin here, I think the history of actually trying to recruit or advertise Germans to come here specifically explains and provides, you know, the basis for why so many Germans came here. We can see the hallmarks of the large amounts of European migration in here in contemporary dialects of Wisconsin. But whether this actually leads to more acceptance of immigrants or immigrant languages here or there, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that's still for us to decide in the future of how we treat new immigrant languages and old immigrant languages too.
But I think when you look at all these cases in the book, the immigrants come here, period, and then language issues follow. And so those language issues and follow sort of fall out in a particular pattern. And there's a lot to be learned from some of those patterns, like the German pattern, how German, in a sense, was used in Milwaukee particularly or throughout the state, but then has sort of given way to English in many ways and how they were in tension for a while. And then you see that now, I mean, with Spanish and with Hmong, how within those communities there's also a tension and how there's a transition taking place. And we have a lot to learn from what happened with those older immigrants with the new immigrants.
That is true. In my personal opinion, one of the most interesting things here is actually the difference between the older immigrants and the newer immigrants, in that it appeared that it took the older immigrants, so the good old German immigrants, much, much, much longer to transition over to English as opposed to the new immigrants, especially the Spanish-speaking immigrants. They are transitioning over to English much quicker now, as quickly as they possibly can, as opposed to the older immigrants that took 3-4 generations to do so.
And some of that has to do with societal pressures. So there's a lot of framework with regard to schools, churches, and family life in terms of having immigrants come in or old immigrants come in. And with the state, in a sense, advertising come here, you had some setup and some tolerance of that. And I think nowadays there are still churches. There are churches that have Hmong that's spoken in or Spanish. You'll see once those start to switch over to English, then you're going to start to lose a lot of the language. There's not a lot of the other structure. There are, you know, tiendas and so on and so forth, and those help maintain. So having, say, a hairdresser who speaks Hmong and then the Hmong go there, that'll preserve the contact because you're engaging it in the language at that point. And without some of those structures and some of those peripheral things, the turnover is much faster. I think some of the pressures in society now are not as supportive of language maintenance as they were in the past.
So there is a big community element in the practice of these languages.
Correct.
What are some of the linguistic mannerisms that are found in Wisconsin, and why is it important that we know about them?
It's always important to sort of know where you're from. That's one aspect of it. And it's also important to know where the other person that you're talking to is from. And identity and cohesion in a conversation is important to anybody. So usually when students live in Wisconsin and then they go out of the state for a while, all of a sudden it's apparent that something's different about their speech. And there's a number of markers, both in syntax and in the sounds, and then in also the words that they use. And those markers mark them out as being different from the place that they've gone to visit. Something that we might actually associate more with Chicago, which is de Bears, de Bulls. But you find this also in Packers, right, where people will make an S sound when it should be like a Z sound. But this happens in German, it happens in Dutch, it happens in a number of languages. And we wanted to look at the influence. We found that younger speakers actually took that as a marker and worked that into their speech more often than, say, even their previous generation. And that was remarkable. So that got us thinking that there's a lot going on in Wisconsin that's really interesting.
One of my favorite discussions in class is telling the class of, you know, nice Wisconsin-born students and all of you Wisconsin listeners that Wisconsin is unique and weird in having the past tense of the verb to dive into a pool as dove. And this is unusual with the rest of the country. And so when people occasionally look down on somebody for using the wrong tense of something, it makes people rethink their judgments when they find out it's like, oh, by the way, you know, your behavior of I dove into the pool, people not from around here may hear you say that and think that, you know, you're uneducated because obviously the past tense is dived. So one of the things of knowing what are the unique markers of a particular community or a speech group, I think allows people to think about their own judgments about differences in other groups of speeches.
And you bring up an interesting point, I think, about what we consider standard English and how there are actually many different types of standard English. Some forms might use a different past tense, like dove, as you said. In academic settings, what we call formal standard English is usually used. But what makes this different from some of the other forms of standard English? What about informal standard English?
Oh, the different types of formal versions of language is really defined by kind of who makes the decision or who defines what is standard or not. So formal standard English is defined by groups of experts and basically books. And we also want to recognize that the only really real version of formal standard English is written English, is that it's only when it's written can it actually be formal standard. And you can look up in a book, Descriptive Grammar of English, of the writing rules of this is how you do it. The informal standard of English is a variety spoken, and this is completely defined by local communities. So using dove as the past tense of dive is standard here in Wisconsin because that's how the community behaves. The community has decided for that. It is not standard, say, in Western Pennsylvania where I grew up. And so the standards really differentiate by who has the power to decide what they are. And the version that everybody thinks exists, this formal standard English, is just purely in books. Whereas the actual, you know, in my opinion, more important, the local informal standard is completely community driven. And it's the community that you grow up with and feel most comfortable with and belonging to. Everybody learns what the standards are there on their own. And then you can see where people deviate from them.
The greatest deviation usually occurs in ones that are ethnically affiliated. Historically, in the United States, that's been with the African-American English community. In terms of the choices that that community makes about language, they're not really choices in the sense that we think, oh, okay, I'm going to make this choice. I have a choice that way. But in terms of the way that it's developed over time and the whole history of African-American English, it sets itself out from standard white English in many particular ways. So that whole issue about standardization, particularly in the schools, in terms of the workplace, those are going to come up strongest in communities that have the most divergent speech forms, generally African-American English speech communities and also, say, even the Chicano English speech community.
Do you think that it's important that children are introduced to these different forms of English in school, that they have an understanding of dialects different than their own?
That's actually important. So there's two ways to take your particular question. One way to take it is a child who speaks a non-standard variety, should they be exposed, say, to other varieties such as standard? And so that's generally the sort of big thing talking about education and how non-standard dialect speakers should conform or not conform. But also the other way around, for standard students who are close to the standard, individuals close to the standard, should they be exposed to more non-standard varieties? And I think in many ways they are exposed to non-standard varieties through media and so on and so forth, also through their friends if they have more contact with non-standard speakers. And I think that's healthy just to understand it. If they also understand that the forms that other people speak are not right or wrong, then they don't develop some of the biases that we use that as a flag for that person who's different later in life. And it's very important. Although language gets used that way sort of automatically, we use it as a flag and it ends up being used in discriminatory ways. So I think it's important for children early on in schools not to be sort of homogenizing the community and then making those who can't manage that variety as being very different.
I really don't think the idea that kids aren't being exposed to varieties of non-standard dialects can be maintained at all, because even in standard Wisconsin English, all the children are being exposed both to the informal standard but then also the vernacular non-standard. You know, so like all of the kids know all the bad words. They hear us when we're talking freely. And so they're aware of variation in language there too. So if we begin to ask the question of like, is it helpful or harmful of them being exposed to other informal standard or other informal non-standards, they're already seeing and aware of the variation to begin with. And so I actually think in school, if you actually – the younger that you can start talking to the kids about this and teaching them about this, the better they can begin to manipulate and use and know, you know, you don't say those words because you don't say those words in those situations. And, you know, this other person talks differently, but that's just because they're from a different neighborhood and it doesn't mean anything like that. And so you can begin the discussion of manipulating language behaviors for everybody, which everybody does, in more productive ways. You know, so you teach people to go to job interviews in, you know, nice clothes. You know, you teach people to use nice language when you go to a job interview. But, you know, when you're sitting around on the playground with your friends, you don't have to use nice language, and it's okay.
Eric Ramey and Tom Purnell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison, and Thomas Purnell is a professor of English at UW-Madison. They're the co-editors and they're contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State, published by UW Press. They spoke with Rachel Bloom. We'll continue a conversation about linguistic diversity next with one expert who says it can have a profound effect on how kids are taught in schools. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier in the show, we explored the languages and dialects of Wisconsin as well as prejudice surrounding them. Dr. Anita Pandey says such bias can have a particular impact on education. She's a professor of linguistics and coordinator of professional communication at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Speaking with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley in March, Pandey applied her research to Milwaukee's diverse student population. She started, though, by explaining why she prefers the term Black English Vernacular, or BEV, to the more common term Ebonics.
A lot of people reject the term. They feel that it, number one, it sort of focuses only on the phonology, the sounds. And a lot of people, African Americans specifically, reject the term because they feel it sort of labels them. And ironically, research shows that more non-African Americans are now using this dialect because of popular culture, including in South Africa as well.
In terms of education, what's the relationship between being bilingual and speaking two dialects, being bidialectal?
I would say they are very analogous. My study back in 2000, I actually compared how African-American speakers of Black English vernacular from the inner city, predominantly Chicago area, performed comparably to low-level ESL students, English as a second language students, for whom, for instance, another language is spoken at home predominantly. So they're similar, and I actually advocate using similar practices, additive language practices, where you actually put both dialects. And see, the term dialect is essentially a variety of a language.
And how are these issues playing out in Milwaukee, a city recent data says is 40% African American and over 17% Hispanic?
Very, very good question you've asked. Milwaukee, like most places in the Midwest and all over the country, is seeing a population change. And what we're seeing is that the schools are relatively underprepared. So many of the teachers, for instance, were prepared for a time period when the predominantly white student population of a certain social class was the predominant population. And now we are seeing increased diversity. And what you see is consistently underperforming students in reading. reading, language arts, according to the latest data, mathematics, and this is on the Wisconsin Knowledge and Concepts exam. And so you see this pattern of a city that is increasingly minority culturally, and yet the teaching population is predominantly white and female. And unless the teachers have professional development or have been trained in cultural diversity and in embracing the home language, then the students are not going to be performing at the level that we're looking to see. So, in fact, ironically, the latest research shows that the choice schools are not outperforming the MPS schools and that it has nothing to do with school type. It has everything to do with pedagogy.
For these Milwaukee students who are coming from backgrounds that don't involve standard English, what are some of the disadvantages they face?
The first disadvantage they face is that many of them are treated like they don't come with the knowledge base. So, for instance, if you don't recognize the home language, then the children do not have a bridge to the school culture. Because language, as I argue in my book, Language Building Blocks, is the centerpiece of instruction. Language is it's both the means, the vehicle, as well as the end. And if you do not develop a child's language skills, this includes vocabulary, pronunciation, then they will have trouble with reading. And many of these students, especially, for example, Hispanic students, are coming from oral cultures where, for instance, poetry and the spoken word is very alive and well, especially in African-American cultures. And then you come to a school culture that emphasizes reading, but without equipping the children, and there's a dissonance between the phonetic languages and then standard English, which is a very confusing language as it is, and a dialect, because the reading does not resemble the speech form. So the students are often at a loss unless you use, for example, debate and more participatory styles of learning, which are more the exception than the rule.
And you mentioned reading. Some studies indicate reading to children is essential for academic achievement, and others place less importance on it. But if reading to children does improve academic achievement, does the dialect or language of that text matter?
Absolutely. When you're using, for example, just predominantly standard English-based texts, not only is there a cultural divide, you know, students perform better when the text is familiar to them, when they have an interest in the substance. And also, if the dialect is familiar, and they're very arbitrary in the case of English. And also, you have a class distinction. Many of the minorities come from a different social class. In fact, Milwaukee has the highest case of a lack of suburbanization of African Americans. So most of them are concentrated, 90%, in the inner city. And while some Hispanic populations are now settling in some of the other areas, we still see a predominant class distinction where, for example, the reading-writing tradition is not something that is embraced in the home. It's more of a spoken and an oral tradition, and we don't recognize these hidden literacies. So unless we as teachers investigate what is happening in the homes of these students and have them create their own literature or co-create them with their families, we're not bridging the home and the school and the primary and the secondary cultures, and that's why these students are predominantly failing.
What happened in Oakland, California in the 1990s that was so important to this discussion?
What happened was, as you know, the Oakland School District discovered and actually took action when there was a large dropout rate reported in the Oakland schools area, and they decided that most of their students were coming to the classrooms with a home dialect that at that time was dubbed Ebonics, which they said was genetically related to English and was misunderstood. They didn't realize that they were referring to the connections and the mutual intelligibility between standard English and this home dialect. And so there was another iteration of that particular bill. And what they were trying to do is use the home dialect, namely Ebonics, and use it using bidialectal readers to teach children standard English. Now, this is an approach termed contrastive analysis. You put both the dialects on the same level. You can use elicitation to get the children to provide the different dialect versions. And as a group, you can collectively show that what the students know is just as important as what they're going to learn, namely standard English. And that they can switch back and forth in literature. You see some of the best awards, including the Booker Prize and Pulitzer's, going to people who are using language, namely standard English creatively all over the world, like African dialects or versions of it and Indian English. So you see that there is a recognition of a creativity in English, which is a global language, and we need to recognize that in the United States as well.
Oakland's story did prompt at least some talk of considering Ebonics in education in Milwaukee. Could accounting for the Black English vernacular here and now help kids in Milwaukee learn?
Absolutely. I am very confident that if we were to try contrastive analysis and the additive language approach where all teachers were informed in the area of social linguistics, either by way of workshops or through training like the Target program at Salisbury University on the eastern shore of Maryland, where the teachers have gone back and after several years they see improved test scores in reading and math and science, we will see some very, very wonderful results. I can guarantee you of that.
Some people say the Black English vernacular, BEV, is improper. So why do you celebrate it?
I celebrate it because these are all terms created by those in positions of power to undermine the people who are still struggling to be recognized. So it's a class distinction. African-American English has contributed to the wealth and the diversity of standard English, not just at the vocabulary level, but in terms of discourse. And that is, the, for example, greetings and the popular culture, the rhyme and rhythm of an oral culture that makes music and learning faster, because when you learn using rhyme, you remember more, you are able to memorize math more, and it should be celebrated because it can help our children learn much faster, not just African-American students, but all students and all home languages that these children are bringing can contribute to everybody's success.
And when you talk about celebrating who kids are when they come to the classroom, how does that validation of their linguistic and possibly cultural background help them psychologically learn?
Very, very good question. I cannot overemphasize this. When children feel that they are recognized, there's a confidence. It's a sense of recognition of your roots. When you do not hear your language or your dialect mentioned or used in any formal fashion, you imbibe the belief that it is not important. So you see a lot of children rejecting their home languages, developing a sense of insecurity, or being told not to speak their home languages, as many special educators advise children who take on symptoms of Asperger's syndrome, which is not necessarily the case that they have it, but maybe they're still at the level where their language, because language, there is no timetable for language. And maybe they're just traumatized. When you take out the home language, you have cases of high dropout rates. And ironically, or rather, you see that Milwaukee and Racine in the last year alone had the highest dropout rates. And that's not surprising. But you also see students in different parts of the country, and not just in Milwaukee, for example, disappearing because, like in the case of Texas, in El Paso School District, there was a superintendent who disappeared students to improve test scores. And so I'll give you the analogy of the roots. When you cut out the roots, 10% of the students, when you immerse them in standard English environments, will take root. But the vast majority, 90%, will wilt. And so you really need to validate the home language because it is who these students are. And if you don't feel accepted, you don't feel comfortable, you don't feel like learning.
In general, how would Milwaukee benefit educationally from a fresh look at language and dialects?
They would flourish because Milwaukee is home to so much diversity. It is in the right spot, you know, geographically. It has the WIDA consortium there. It can contribute so much to this country and already has. And if we take this diversity and tap it, we will see that the United States is not just underprepared for the global era that we're living in, but is part of it. So if you contrast, for example, the number of students abroad speaking another language, over 80% worldwide versus the United States, only 6%, we can see that we're underprepared for the globalization that's happening. And we can begin by tapping the diversity in our midst and using that to prepare ourselves for this wonderful future that lies ahead of us.
Dr. Anita Pandey teaches linguistics at Morgan State University in Baltimore. She's the author of Language Building Blocks. She spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. Our interview first aired in March. Some thoughts on the calendar from a Lake Effect essayist come your way after a break on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. School has just started, Labor Day just passed, and already some of our listeners are looking ahead to New Year's. Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank is one such person.
Christmas is late this year. Bosh, you say. It is the same this year as every year, December 25th. Well, yes and no. It depends on how you look at it. Christmas is certainly December 25th according to the dominant cultural norm and legally mandated system of our society, the calendar decreed for the Western world by Pope Gregory XIII. Having a widely agreed-upon standard for marking time is extremely useful. Without one, how would a person know when the World Series started or the day to cast her next vote for president? But the numbering of time is arbitrary. Pope Gregory proclaimed his calendar 431 revolutions around the sun ago, basing a year in his system on the time such a planetary journey takes. That also makes the Gregorian system useful, as it coordinates seasons and timekeeping. By Gregory's reckoning, the new system started in the year 1582, marking its distance in revolutions of the earth around the sun since the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. To Muslims, however, it was in the year 1003, or perhaps 1004, measuring the time since Muhammad made his journey from Mecca to Medina. To Jews, it was in 5,342, or 43, in theory, the number of years since the creation of the world. Just as Pope Gregory's year starts on January 1st, the Jewish year, Rosh Hashanah, starts on the first of the month of Tishrei. This year, that is sunset today, September 4th, on the Gregorian calendar, 112 days before Christmas. In the next Gregorian year, the first of Tishrei will fall at sunset September 24th, 92 days before Christmas. In the Gregorian year 2016, Jewish New Year's is sunset October 2nd, a mere 84 days before the Christian holiday. So, if you measure seasons as I do, and Jewish New Year is your annual pole star, then Christmas is late this year and early 3 years from now. As I said, it all depends on how you look at it.
Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in Milwaukee Magazine and Corporate Report Wisconsin Magazine, among other places. Finally, tomorrow on the show, we'll speak with several people, including longtime Milwaukee musician Sam Yannis, former member of the Bodines, about the Milwaukee premiere of the stage show A Day for Grace. It's a project that combines two startlingly similar stories, one captured in a spoken word performance by Doug Vincent and music Yannis recorded for his 1998 solo album A Good Day to Die. The album and the stage show include the title track from that album, which was inspired by the suicide of Yannis' brother years before. Here is Sam Yannis singing that song in the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
He liked to party. He liked to skip school. He was no stranger to the wrong side of the law. Maybe it's hard when you're second of seven. Maybe he listened to some voices that would call, oh, 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 oh. One time he told me out in the backyard, we were shooting hoops and shooting the sass. Sammy, you're smart, you got a good soul, so if you blow it, I'm gonna kick your ass. Ooh, oh. Oh, oh, oh. He took the car and ran away for 30 days, California. Oh, 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 oh. Ooh. Tonight it feels like such a waste. I can barely recall his face. And then one morning I woke up early. I could hear somebody cry. It was my mother, my broken mother, and I could tell from the look in her eyes.
Sam Yanis playing A Good Day to Die, part of a show called A Day for Grace that will have its Milwaukee premiere on Thursday. We'll hear more about it on tomorrow's show. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.
It was a good day. I hope it was a good day. It was a good day.